So there we go.
Not make a misstep.
We're talking about utility and meaning out of this weekend.
Yeah.
Who am I talking with?
This is Shell. Shell Money, Money Bikes.
You know, I was just in Fort Collins, and I did an interview with James Bleakey.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked with him for a bit, right?
I did. James was extremely generous and, like, took me under his wing.
He's a really cool dude.
Yeah.
So I was in his shop, and I don't know if you saw it on my website. I have a long-form interview with him,
okay,
as well as photos of his shop and stuff like that.
That
kind of brought you up most recently,
because
he mentioned you.
All right.
You know?
Okay.
And amongst other people, too. And it's like, about people that he'd been around and who were doing stuff.
Well, he's very generous because all those people are the people that I've learned from James. And that's like Chris Solfrain, Reeb, that's Moon Men Bikes. You know, I came out of that shop. Oddity, you know, shared that shop space and learned a bunch from James. So he's got a whole line of people. And so if... you know, if he let you know about half of that, like he's you know, humble guy. And
he's a humble guy,
and does great work. He's a craftsman. So.
He absolutely does. You know, years ago, and this is like we're probably jumping back to 2010 or something like that.
My God, okay.
We were sitting outside of a hand-built bike show, and I think it was Drew from Engine was there and a few other people, and we were talking about that we need to build a frame builder family tree. Because, as you know, like, you come out of, in a way, Black Sheep, right? And James came out of where he came from, or whatever.
Boulder Bikes,
that's it.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, these lineages and these ways we look at bikes gets passed down.
Yep.
And there's family, it's a family tree.
Who do you think's high on that? Who's your people on top of the American tree? Like a Fatic or like...
Oh, no, definitely not. It's, it's what's his name that, He was known for teaching all the guys like Gordon and everything like that.
Okay.
In terms of early American frame building. And of course, we can't forget Ignaz, you know, in all that, because we're talking about Grand Poobah there. Mm-hmm. You know, but like, I don't think that's important, because we place a lot of effort, energy on who was first or earliest or that kind of thing. There's points where there were real changes in course.
Okay.
There were, because from my perspective, I mean, if we're going to go down and have this discussion,
I'm listening.
It's, there were people that went to Europe, learned some stuff, and brought it over here and taught other people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, great. That was needed. That was important.
Yeah.
But let's say out of these lineages, somebody like, let's say, Chris Chance.
Okay.
He comes out of, he came out of the Whitcomb and Richard Saxon Stowe Bikes sort of world there.
Okay.
And, but he goes and takes a left turn, like, we're going to make fancy bikes and we're going to weld them.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that comes Merlin and Titanium.
Yeah.
And shit like that. So what's more important, these, I mean, it's not so much more important, but what are critical places to focus on?
Sure.
And the thing is, I think more along those lines of there was a point at which a change in direction was made, and this is important now.
Okay.
We don't braze bikes. Well, you braze bikes together. We don't use lugs exactly.
Okay.
Or, you know, if you're really pushing at things, you need to be more flexible than that. And out of that, you know, you have like a Land Shark in America where you're fillet brazing, but you're not constrained by lugs or tube shape.
Okay.
You're Chris Chance, where you're like, we're going to weld bikes, and they're going to be awesome, and we're going to bring it to the next level. Various points like that. And I like looking at that a little bit more than the earliest people, and I'm drawing a blank on the names of these people. But, you know.
All right, here's a question for you.
Okay.
Today, what is that turn? What is significant? Because you just mentioned we're welding bikes. We don't use lugs. That's all. Those are all, like, turning points,
30, 40 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so what is that? How do you see that today?
Without question,
who's 3D, turning and where?
Well, without question, 3D printing is having a huge effect on what's possible at the craft level, or let's just say, not mainstream manufacturing, because I don't think 3D printing has much of an effect on them. Like, when you're talking about Trek and Specialized, they've had the ability to use forged aluminum parts in their frames for a long time, or even before that, investment cast steel parts to their specification.
It democratized it and let everyone.
It brought it down. And the thing is, it gives small people that build one or 20 bikes a year the chance to work on that level that was exclusive to larger manufacturers before, which I think is, that's the big shift technology-wise.
Okay.
There's other stuff. I think, I'm wondering if, and this might be jumping it more, the change in how prepreg carbon fiber is coming in terms of shelf life and refrigeration needs, in terms of will we, as smaller people, have better access to prepreg carbon fiber at the onesie-twosie level. Because unless you're going through enough carbon fiber, you can't really get into prepreg because of the shelf life and the refrigeration needs. And or are you making a huge investment for just one bike? And
well, here's the question though. Is
You want me to name drop someone? It's tough to do in this crowd.
Like, if you feel like doing it. But okay, so you have Pursuit, or you have people doing small. So you just named like this technology of possibly like bringing prepreg to a small operation or something like that. But do you think that's holding it back? Because I don't think if the smaller builders make better carbon bikes, there will be an interest in boutique carbon. You know, because that crowd, I feel like that guy's buying an S-Works.
Sure, you know what I mean? Absolutely.
And so I feel like I'm sitting in steel because because I know my limitation, but it's my, also my niche.
You know what I mean?
So
this is, this comes into my perspective, and my perspective isn't how does somebody like you compete with S-Works carbon bikes or make something, a product similar. I want to see innovation. I want to see new directions. That's generally what I'm looking at in terms of like, are we using things in new and better ways? Are we doing things, or are the right people getting access that couldn't before? Like, 3D printing has helped me out a lot recently. And thank you very much. And I've been trying to use it, but at the same time, I've been in a good position in terms of access to machine shop and machine tools, knowing people, getting stuff machined on my own. I've been able to do things new entrants can't do for a long time. But with the whole new 3D printing thing, high school kids have the access to the same technologies I do. With offshore CNC machining, it's, you can get CNC machining done in China and anodized and laser marked at a price point that makes it possible for a junior high school kid to take on a project, and if they're communicating it well, they end up with something as good or better than what that Contra bike over there, or any of these bikes, they could instantly do. They just have to learn to weld, learn to glue, learn to learn the processes, learn the CAD, and learn the engineering. But the thing is, having a machine shop isn't the biggest barrier now. Well, now all of a sudden, I'm looking at entrance to the market, or into the creative space that couldn't have been there before that now are. And there's some talented motherfuckers out there. There's some good ideas coming up. And it's, that to me is exciting. It also is terrifying because, let's say from a status point of view, I have to fight better, fight harder to hold that. Because it's easier now to compete with me and knock me down and bring someone else up.
100%.
In all the best senses of the word, and so to me, that's what's exciting right now. Also, 3D solid modeling. One of the big things that I've exploited over the years, I mean, if we're talking that, is actually doing real 3D solid modeling to do frame building. And Frame builders never had to do that. And I was almost talking a foreign language always at a bike show when I'd talk about 3D models and everything like that. Well, now with 3D printing, now everybody's talking about 3D models. Now everybody's starting to learn CAD. Now everybody's actually looking at the lines on paper in a way that they never really did before. And I love that.
Mm-hmm.
People are now learning the language that I've been speaking.
Sure, yeah.
But just like with 3D printing, that means that kid in Des Moines could suddenly just start doing shit way better than me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what's his name? Colin Ray, if you know who that kid is.
I don't know that one.
He's some fucking college kid. And he's killing it right now.
Yeah, yeah.
This kid is way smarter than me. And, you know, he's young and he's going down his little rabbit holes. But the thing is, by the time he's 25 or 30, he is going to be running... I mean, he's already running circles around a lot of people, but he is just going to be decimating everything in his path by then, you know? And it's like, we're seeing... And with the internet and the sharing world, we see that more. And that's... I mean, all that stuff's really exciting in my world.
Yeah.
So when I see... When I talk about left-hand turns, I don't... I'm not thinking about the ancient history stuff. Or if I am, I'm thinking about what got us here and what's taking us to the next place.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
You know? And it's like a lot of, like this bike that we're looking at right here, this kid's bike, it's a little push bike, and it's delicate, it's nice, and it's sized well, and it's got a beautiful look with your fillet brazing and stuff like that. And then you've got a clunker over there with a proper coaster brake. And it's kind of that, you know, what are you doing here? It's like, this isn't state-of-the-art manufacturing, but it's your ability to make your vision and your language and your what you're trying to say in a room holds up in a room like this.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it does.
Nice. Yeah.
And that's the thing is that, like I've said before, there's all different places within the frame building world. Some people want a canvas, some people want to launch to the moon.
Right.
And it's everything in between.
Sure.
And
we really know our role and like what appeals to people. You know, it's not all just steampunk, but that's definitely an angle of where we're at. And so you can see that's like what we ride and the bikes that we produce, and definitely lean into our niche. You know what I mean?
And raw has a place in a world full of, like, I as much as I love technology and innovative tools and ways of doing things, I don't want electronic shifting on my bicycle. I'm not a fan. Because it, like, I have motorcycles. I can have an electric motorcycle or an e-bike or a bicycle. A bicycle is not an e-bike and it's not a motorcycle. A bicycle is something else.
Yeah.
And when you, and for someone else, it might not be this way. But for me, I want my bike to be an analog machine.
Yeah. I want less steps between me and my bike ride. And so if I got the batteries or I got the shoes or I got the shorts, I'm not against any of it, to each their own. But for me personally, I just want to get done out of the shop, pick up the bike, and I'm gone.
Well, I think that shows up in your work. We're looking at a clunker with a coaster brake. I mean, it's actually not even a clunker. It's a cruiser, right?
There you go. Let's, yeah.
Because a clunker would have handbrakes, right? Yeah, so it's a cruiser.
Lots of pitfalls there.
And the thing is, it's like... It's very elemental. It's very no frills.
Yeah.
There's less on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a beautiful bike. It's got all that stuff, as is this. And it's like, I mean, are these titanium spokes?
Not quite.
Not quite.
I've gone a ways, but...
They look colored or something like that. Are they colored?
No, I think they're just... It's a funky wheel build, though. You can see it's, what, 2-cross? That was probably my first mistake there.
Yeah, well, I'm an also... I mean, these are, what, 12-inch rims? 12-inch rims, and you're using high-flange spokes. I mean, high-flange hubs in a 12-inch rim.
That's kind of what you want.
Well, yeah, because this kid's getting so sideways.
Yeah.
You know?
You want the support. You want the support. It was a 20-hole issue. The only rim, 20 hole, the only hub, 20 hole.
Okay, so
I called my friends at Paul and I said, I know you got 20 hole over there. And say, yeah.
But the thing is, you know, and this is kind of that fun thing when you're solving new and different problems.
Sure.
And maybe you're solving old and different problems.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the thing is that when we work against convention, when we work against what's been commodified in the market space as normal, let's say, or typical, we run into problems. You just said 20-hole rim, 20-hole hub. How do I make that happen?
Yeah, yeah.
And, well, you got forced into a high flange. And it's like, and the thing is, it's like, it's absolutely absurd on this bike.
Thank you for noticing.
In all the rad ways.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's utterly absurd. And those wheels are so sick.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that's kind of the cool thing. That's the magic, right?
Let me show you about this bike.
Okay. Oh, we got another one.
So,
okay, is this the 16?
16. This is the same frame and fork. So you buy your child a frame and fork.
Oh,
and
so it goes up in size.
Yeah.
So that's another. How do you sneak that in so that on either bike you don't know?
Mm-hmm.
From a let's say design.
I like that you
aesthetic.
Know. I like that you know. The immediate first problem is how do you make this bike look good? How do you make that bike look
absolutely.
Good? How do both of them ride right?
And how do they ride right? Yeah exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing is that you're talking and you've got little baby cruiser bars, which is dope.
Yeah. So these start the 19 mil, the small grip, and then the short cockpit. Everything small about
right.
One. And then all you have is a new seat post, stem bars, and then it turns into an Adler curve.
I really wish you had a 7/8 stem on there. Uh-oh, here it comes.
I got these.
You did a
so this
a
is the new super
one.
Light. Yeah, these are M5 binders, which don't exist, so these are machined.
Right.
This whole thing is like a pretty expensive endeavor, but this weighs just about what a Thompson or a boxcar or any of these other aluminum stems.
Sure.
So it was...
And it's 7/8 to go with those types of parts.
7/8,
but I mean, is this 7/8, and you would apply this on in a mountain bike situation also?
That's one.
So
right
that's
there,
got
yeah.
it right there. So
yep.
you've got an ecosystem for this 7/8
yep.
construction.
And I have the whole... There, I have 31/8 in four sizes, 7/8 four sizes, and then I have a 35 stubby.
Right. Because I went through my clunker phase, if you saw those, and I ended up on, before I went to my unitized bars,
okay.
I used the Von Sothen 26 millimeter 7/8 stem.
Okay. I don't know that one.
Oh, it's a BMX brand.
Okay.
It was a fringe race brand from Santa Cruz.
Right.
I don't know how long they lasted, but they because of the 7/8, you can do a 26 millimeter offset, I think. And
yes, here you go. This is 27, I think.
There
I
you
think
go.
That's the number.
Something like that. But these were machined, right? And they're
cool.
BMX style.
Yeah.
And so I was like, fuck yeah, I'm getting that because I'm going to use 7/8 bars for the clunker. And it's like so sick, you know? And
oh, I get it.
And these are, exactly, you get these details because, you know, obviously I do the bikes that I do,
sure.
but when I'm going into the clunker space, like I did, say, with the Red Baron and the Sopwith Camel bikes that I did, like, I had to use a 7/8 stem. I mean, you don't, like, you have to use a 7/8 stem. So it's like, you know, you have to be in... You have to know the language of the people,
sure.
right? You have to be true to what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And if you're mixing metaphors in the wrong ways, it turns into a mess.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stay with it, like you believe that this is so important, you have three different stem specifications
totally.
That
you wanna see another one?
Will take into account that.
This is a 1-inch threadless steer going to a 31/8 clamp.
Okay.
It's a bit of a rare bird.
Yeah.
But this is kind of like old school fixie. I have a fixie here, and like I wanted the most fixie. So I kind of like went back to what they were doing like early aughts and stuff. It's kind of fun, but then you get the weird combo 31/8.
That's a whole thing, man.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's cool. Yeah. You know, I really appreciate what you're doing in your bikes, and when I see it, that it's like you've got your thing. I mean, you call it. I wouldn't necessarily call your bike steampunk, and I wouldn't refer to it that way. but they're fillet braised.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, they're fillet braised, but that's been a thing in cycling for a long time. It's not steampunk necessarily,
right.
Unless of course you did do a steampunk bike that had all sorts of odd,
maybe copper hard lines.
Exactly. Copper. Yeah. So you're coming out of a steampunk phase. Like you did that. Now you're kind of keeping
it. I'm like you. I don't call it that.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not. It's easily and relatable,
uh-huh.
And that's kind of the first thing that comes out for people.
Okay.
It would be a harder thing to quantify or like designate where we come from, but I think we come from riding first. All these
absolutely,
bikes, yeah. All these bikes are riders for sure.
That to me is everything.
Yeah,
it's so, got to be about the ride.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, but while I have you here and we have a proverbial witness,
yeah,
I did reach out. So
yes, you did.
The first thing I want to say, if you have a bike around, anything in near my size or even one of your bikes, I would love to ride one of your bikes.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'8".
Be a little squeeze. All I brought was my road bike.
Okay.
My new road bike. I'm going to ride to Chris King tonight.
Okay.
You're welcome to jump on it if you want.
Yeah.
It'll just, I'm 5'10 and a half, 5'10".
Yeah, sure.
So it's a little bit more of a reach,
yeah.
But you can get on that and see. And what's interesting about that, from my perspective, for people maybe here, you know, I've done a lot of bike stuff over the years. But largely, where I've really been fighting the fight has been in the dirt for the past, say, decade.
Sure.
And just recently, I built two road bikes. And it's like, and they're definitively road plus bikes, not gravel bikes.
Mm-hmm.
But they're my vision of what a road bike is.
Yeah.
In the practical use of road bikes.
Yeah.
Not in the Instagram world, but just like riding around.
I've read enough PVD where I know you have like a fresh perspective and you really...
To me, it's old. To me, I'm looking for fresh perspective
here.
Well,
sure, absolutely. But you have something that seems to be under the influence of your own kind of theories and thoughts and then a lot of riding and that iteration loop of riding and redesigning and going back and what, you know...
What worked, what didn't.
Yeah, I'm not constrained in any way and this is the...
That's truly what it's been. I mean, honestly, I don't have customers and I build 2 to 3 bikes a year and they're for me or my wife or with a buddy for them or whatever like that and it... And I really, I'm into R&D.
Yeah.
That's my bag.
Sure.
But when we talk about the D part of that, most people drop off.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about development, it's like, yeah, you made the bike. Now ride it.
Mm-hmm.
Now take notes.
Yeah.
Now evaluate it.
Mm-hmm.
Now be critical.
Yeah.
Now figure out where it fails, where it works. And then on your next version of that, read back all your notes and fix that shit.
Yeah.
And do that over and over and over again. Over and over and over again.
Yeah. And make sure you're accurate so the data that you're getting back in your riding and the feel and then hard data if you have any, that you know where you were so that your next iteration is an answer to that instead of just like, oh, this idea and I hope I got close and then you don't, you know.
Right. So there's times for just new ideas like, oh, I want to try this.
Yeah.
I think that'd be neat.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, it's iterative on refinement, refinement, refinement. It's the boring hard work of it.
Sure.
And it's like, I mean, I'm willing to bet you have those moments because you're not doing ordinary stuff in this ecosphere. You've got your own thing. And you get to do something and it's like you find out if it worked well.
Yeah.
You find out if it had shortcomings. And maybe the shortcomings were in manufacturing. Maybe the shortcomings were in just, I can't get brass in there. It's a pitch.
Yeah.
How do I fix that on the next one, you know? And all that.
Go, what's up?
And the thing is, we keep doing that, but you have to pay attention to that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I see too many people, I mean, to shit talk generally, that they've been making exactly the same obvious mistake for 25 or 30 years and haven't noticed yet.
Sure.
And I wonder, what's going on that they haven't even noticed?
Mm.
How about this? to use a mainstream brand, I was putting together an IBIS for a roommate that I had.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, you heard of them.
Okay.
And this is
a California company.
This is a carbon fiber bike. It was one of their Mojos or something. No, it was going back a little further. Okay. It was one of the Mojos or something. Okay. But it was a carbon fiber bike, which means you certainly had to have modeled it extensively in CAD prior to doing this, and you would think you'd have a little bit of testing behind you and everything. And I was trying to cable her bike.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally, just I'm trying to cable the bike.
Yeah.
And it was impossible. I was like, there's no way to cable this bike. It could be done,
mm-hmm.
but it will be terrible.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, hadn't anybody at IBIS...
One iteration would have...
Have you ever put cables on a bike?
Right.
Why is this not a thing? And the thing is, nobody else mentions this anywhere ever. And I'm like, so nobody else is cabling this bike the way I do or think that I should? I mean, for the viewers at home type of thing, if you're not a frame builder like us or not in control of the variables like we are,
sure.
Like when you're assembling the bike that you just bought, you have a lot of choices to make. Cable length, cable routing path, how does it go?
Yeah.
And those are crucial steps in how a bike ends up working.
Mm.
And if you're not paying attention to that in the way that you don't say, I just bought a new IBIS Mojo and it's fucking garbage, I can't put cables on it right.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't the first thing you notice, then how are you fucking cabling your bikes? When we're talking about high performance, like I use the word high performance a lot.
Sure.
And high performance applies to your bikes as much as my bikes, as much to a Tour de France rider. That cruiser right there. High performance for that would be, does it meet the terms of its existence? The definition for what that bike is supposed to do, does it do it better than anything else you could have done?
Sure.
To meet the rules of that bike.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does it exceptionally well, it's high performance. And if it doesn't do it very well, it's low performance. Same with this child's bike.
Mm.
You know, it's like, does it do the growth thing right?
Sure.
This is a high performance situation. It has to do both of these well. If it's a grocery getter, well, does it fucking get groceries good?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's high performance.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't do it, that's low performance. So let's evaluate things correctly. And I just don't think a lot of people know what high performance is. I think they know what spending money is.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Yeah.
And it's like, just because you spend money and polish a turd doesn't make it fucking high performance.
Yeah.
That clunker or somebody's aerodynamic time trial bike could be equally high performance per the definition of what that bike has to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Peter, I got one more thing before you go.
That's fine. I'm happy to answer.
All right, so I am an iteration junkie. I love riding something, changing it. I've really been in kind of a stunted, but I've done 4 full suspensions, and I find there to be a lot more science and interest in like that category.
Do you not like that?
Say again?
Do not like the math?
No, I do.
Okay.
I came from modeling and engineering. Like, I think this is all craft. Like, there's very little engineering. We picked a few numbers.
There's a lot of design.
Yeah. Okay, sure. I could see that, but in the end, what are there, 6 numbers there? You know?
There's a lot of choices.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Okay.
But the
point is, I do love this iteration, and I really believe in riding everything that you can and just getting all the feedback and everything. And that's why I ended up in your mailbox, because I thought, this guy is a freak. You know, and these things are weird as hell. And I got to see where he went and where that rabbit hole ends up. Because it's not something familiar to me at all. And I'd be so excited to ride one. And that was where I was like, oh, sell me the 3D parts and I'll put one together or whatever.
Right.
But, I'm very interested to see how these things ride, because I see you writing about them.
Sure.
And that's great.
I'm happy to put you on a bike. I don't. It would be easier to put you on one of my wife's bike and have it be small than my bike and be big. But
I'm just excited by that concept to be like, wow, this whole...
What I would say is, if you're an iteration junkie, I mean, if you think that iterating and iterating and iterating is the path to getting better shit and all that stuff, you got to be working in a 3D assembly.
Sure, yeah.
Because when I'm modeling a dropout or whatever, when by the time you see it on a bike, it's gone through 100 iterations.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
It's been looked at from every angle. It's been thought about and conceptualized. I could print it in plastic and get a feel for how it feels in space.
How much mass there is to it.
Or just this, whatever, you know, whatever you're worried about. Because also, 3D CAD on a flat surface isn't the same thing as looking at something in real life or touching it, holding
100%.
It. 100%. Right?
I've machined enough things where I thought, ooh, that wasn't right. What I expected.
Right,
there.
Exactly. Yeah, that wasn't what I thought.
Yeah.
So I would just say you gotta make the investment, and doing it over the winter, like December and January, if that's slow times for you, start like December 1st or whatever you want to pick. From here to there, I'm going to work full-time, 10-hour days, learning 3D modeling in assembly environments so that I can have this bike in the computer and be making changes to it. And when if you like iterating, once you get into that environment, because there's no financial cost, there's no tooling cost, none of what you have to do. And what's cool is you skip steps. You start with a design that was going to be like, oh, I got to buy this fancy reamer to do it, and then I'm going to have to have this fancy thing done. I'll probably have to send it out. And you go through like 30 more iterations because you're continuing to design it. And you find out, oh, wait, there's a way simpler way to do this, and I just do this, and then it's done.
Sure.
And it's like you actually just skipped very expensive learning process that might have taken you 5 months of toil in your garage. Instead, it was 2 weeks on your computer.
Yeah.
And
well, you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
I mean, I work in Pro E exclusively.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you had done. Have you done all your bikes in the?
Yeah. Everything's okay. Everything's modeled.
And I made an assumption that you weren't doing the CAD work.
No, it's fine. But I. Bike CAD.
I could send you a Parasolid if you want to like actually look at a model.
Yeah, sure.
You know, if you're like into name a part or whatever, and I'll say like, here's a Parasolid. You can look into that, because that way you're not getting.
I can't ride your Parasolid. That's all I'm saying.
I get it. I'll get you on the bike, but then you don't get a feature tree, but at least you get to really look at the details.
Sure.
You know,
like that
kind of thing. I don't give out my free feature trees. You know. Come on. Okay, I've got some cool tricks I've learned over the years.
Cool.
Especially in, have you done much modeling for 3D printing?
No.
Okay.
I'm pretty low tech in that way, but I've never used bike CAD. You know, I just came from school.
You should use bike CAD.
I never did.
It's very good.
I've become better at making my models parametric so I can extend head, you know, top tube lengths, and they don't break.
I mean, that's the game, right?
Yeah.
I've done a ton of work, if you've read about the math that I do and all that. So I have my stuff is SolidWorks based.
Okay.
I use a, and I've been meaning to do a post or a video on this. I use a, what's called a master part configuration file.
Okay.
So a part is the definition of the file of all the bikes.
Okay.
And there'll be like 7 bikes that are reconfigured within that.
Okay.
And for me, all that is driving parameters and equations.
Okay.
And construction geometry. There's no sketches. The only thing that gets passed on that's weird is, oh no, I have a sketch for each head tube profile, because we have funny shaped head tubes with all that.
Yep.
And I want to have my parts cut specifically to those shapes.
Yep.
So I actually have a surface of the head tube profile that gets passed on in this. You can have whatever you want passed on. It could be sketches, but I hate sketches in terms of containing data.
Okay.
And then that comes into my master or my full assembly.
Okay.
And my parts get assembled to that. And in each part, that master part file comes into the part to define all the geometry for any part on the bike. So my master part file has all the 3D spatial data for every part everywhere on the bike entirely. All the computations are done within that file, and when they come into a part, like say a dropout, where you need to know where the chain stays and seat stays are coming from and exactly which angle, that's all coming from that file, but it doesn't have to be calculated in that part. So when I'm modeling that part, I'm not doing it in context of an assembly. I'm doing it a part-based. The part is the part. It's not in context, but an assembly part is being used to define geometry in that part. And that methodology for SolidWorks saves a massive amount of processing time and speeds up the rendering of the thing.
It's not super clunky when you get your assembly together. And every single piece is way too rich. And every.
So that's been the thing that I've seen, because, like I said, a lot of people are starting to model more now because of 3D printing. But what I'm seeing is, because I've been doing it for the past, like, I bought SolidWorks. I owned it in 1998.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hard flex.
No, I know. I've been doing this for a while.
I haven't bought very many copies of 3D modeling software in my life, so.
It's brutal.
Oh, yeah.
It's brutal, and you have to damn well mean it. And so that's when I got on board with this. So I've been doing this for a long time.
Sure.
And I've confronted a lot of problems, like, not just modeling methods or techniques, but, like, what pushes my system resources to their limits? What slows the system down? What turns it, like, with SolidWorks, if you do, like, and this is one thing that caused a huge problem for many years, was you can do an in-context assembly-based part where it's reaching into the assembly for data.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is, if that assembly is more than one layer deep, if that assembly is three layers deep and you're reaching into that assembly, it won't update in SolidWorks.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't actually get proper in-context assembly modeling once the assembly has many layers to its and that was a huge problem for a long time. And by going to the master part style, that solves that.
Yeah.
And I've been on that for about a year and a half.
Okay.
I used other methods prior to that, but it's, you know, all these things that we learn over time about best practices.
Sure.
Well, when you go on the internet and someone says, this is how to draw a bike frame in Fusion 360, it's like, yeah, that's great if you're a student and you've been modeling for 2 weeks.
Sure. Yeah.
And you don't know what downstream effects you're actually causing.
Yeah.
Or how this, what happens when you start getting into real difficult, you know, modeling methods. Or,
well, yeah, if you got into industry, that where stuff starts mattering, and that all matters.
Yeah,
you have a complex assembly for a tractor.
And like currently, I used to have three different or different models for different bikes in my CAT.
Okay.
Like different. What's the right way to phrase it? Different assemblies and things like that for each one. And I actually folded them all into one. So now if I'm doing a road bike, I click the road bike link or configuration, and it pops up with a road bike.
Mm.
It swaps bottom brackets, it swaps yokes, it swaps dropouts, or those, like, currently dropouts and yokes for my rear ends.
Yeah.
That's all one file for all my bikes.
Okay.
So if it's a road bike or a mountain bike, it's still the same dropout file that creates that.
Okay.
And there's just different things that happen within the configuration. But like, say, head tubes, where it's like, oh, this is a Paragon head tube versus a Bike Fab Supply head tube. It's like, it actually just switches out the part, you know? And it's like, boom, done. And all that sort of stuff.
As you say this, you keep, I'm thinking more about, oh yeah, that cool yoke that he has.
Yeah, the yoke.
Yeah, so.
You know what?
Sell me a kit. I want to ride and experience a PVD.
Are you on the ride tonight? Today,
sure.
Three?
Yeah,
if you're there, yeah, jump on my bike.
Okay, yeah. No, I would very much value that.
You got a half hour on my bike.
After that, send me a kit. Charge me accordingly. I want it.
We'll see.
I'll give you some good feedback. Trust me.
I hear you. I'm very busy.
Yes.
And
sure,
I'm
just press print
I'm
twice. Two copies. It's a drop down, dude.
You know. Thing is, it's like I am straight out. Like, it was all I could do to get here in terms of what I'm trying to do.
Sure, yeah,
and
yeah,
and all that. It's like we've all got our things, and
yeah, yeah.
I know what you're asking for. I think it's a compliment.
Yeah,
I appreciate
it. I'm here for that. Yeah, yeah,
and it's just a difficult thing because I'm not set up for it, yeah, and it gets into other issues too. Yeah. Anyway,
it's possible.
It is possible. You know what's even more possible? You could give me the bike's geometry. I'd just change a few numbers and it'd just reiterate the whole file.
Okay.
And I could even send out a whole 3D model of the entire frame fully assembled and everything.
Why are we doing this to me right now? Why would you?
Because there's other things involved. I'm sorry. Anyway, awesome stuff.
Thank you.
I think this is a drop-dead gorgeous juvenile bike. I love that it becomes this.
Yeah.
And it looks gorgeous in both configurations. I do like that. I'll give you two critiques.
Yeah, there you go.
Just
okay.
And this is entirely like just me stuff. It's not like dangerous critiques.
I'm not going to feel sad.
I don't like that it has so much spacer under the stem.
Oh, okay.
I try to keep it 5 millimeters personally. I think more than that starts getting on.
You're not in the business.
Me.
You don't understand the resale of a fork.
I get it. I'm like I said, I'm not saying you're doing it wrong. I'm just saying this thing that gets me.
Fair enough.
I'm not a big fan of raw bikes. I like that. It's fine that you expose your fillet brazing.
Sure.
I tend not to like raw bikes, and the darkened heat affected zone kills me.
Because?
I just can't do it. You know why? As a frame builder.
Yes.
Because I only build a couple bikes a year, and because they have to be everything I'm trying to make it into.
Okay.
That feeling, the last day before paint, of, oh my God, it looks like shit. It looks so bad. I can't stand it. It's got so many problems. There's this and then that. How do I make it perfect? It's gonna look like such shit. All that, all those feelings that we've had. It looks like that when I'm feeling all those feelings of inadequacy and failure, and this bike is going to look bad. I've failed. And then, of course, you get it back from paint, and you instantly forget about all that stuff.
Yeah,
and it's like, wow, this looks great.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think what happens there, there's two things. The darkened heat effect zone makes me get into that place. And I tend not to like raw bikes because I think... Almost done. Raw bikes because I feel like it's a novice trick for showing people that you built your bike.
Yeah.
If you notice, most novices want a raw finish. Why? They're trying to gain status by demonstrating to the people around them that they, in fact, built their bike.
Gotcha.
And to me, a bike's not done until it's painted, because that's when a bike's done and everything like that. And you've got a whole different thing. I'm just expressing kind of perspective on it. So it does those two things to me with that. So two things are the only
sounds
things.
Mostly like a you thing.
It's a totally, it is totally a me thing.
We actually, this is pretty rare. The heat affected finish is pretty rare. Most of our stuff looks like this or like this.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, been brushed. And
right. So. And also, you have a customer
that
raw finish, I'm sure, is a very valuable and important part of that scenario.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that.
No, I appreciate all of the feedback. It's great.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like there's definitely bikes that I can point to as like they did that wrong.
Sure.
And then there's things like I that doesn't work for me, and this is a that doesn't work for me thing. But I love that it's got a coaster brake hub. I've always wanted to do a high-end coaster brake hub.
I've iterated. I have one with two sprags in it.
Yeah.
And
it would be a really cool project, and it seems like the kind of thing Paul would get in on.
He's already
It's just like, where is that coaster brake hub the world wants?
QBP went down that rabbit hole. This is all according to what I've heard from here and there. But Q went down for the low side. So they had it all, you know, designed and ready to go. And then I don't know what the number was, but it was too high for the forging. And I think we were that close. For me, we used the Shimano's.
Yeah.
So we take the Shimano's, do the two drive side bearings, like the balls, double up, axles.
There's all the hacks. Obviously, you have a heat sink on it and stuff. But it's like, you know, it's one of those things. When I look at that, I go, oh, if I did a bike like that, that would mean I'd have to make a hub.
Totally.
And I'm not ready for that.
The other part of the design priest, it has to follow the aesthetic. So people have done like cable or hydro actuated disc with a pedal back scenario.
Oh yeah, I have already designed a back pedal hydraulic.
But I say that misses my design brief for sure, because you no longer have a bike that sits on the floor like that with just the. It's a coaster hub. It's not a disc actuated. You know.
Right.
It has to, in my opinion, for my bike.
Right, because if you do a back pedal, disc actuation.
Sure.
You've now joined theme park. And you're not doing it. That's not a theme park. That is a coaster brake.
Yeah.
That's how that works. Versus if you're adapting some goofy mechanism that isn't your hand to actuate the brake on a bicycle, that's not...
Your words, not mine.
Right. Yeah. It's just one of those things. Because if you've iterated, you've been down, you've thought about this stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, you know, anyway. Great stuff. Thanks for talking with me. That was a great long interview.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Okay.
I appreciate you.
I left my recorder at home, so